All right, welcome all. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, and welcome to the end of the year FMS meeting. We have some important work to complete today, and I'm sure we'll get it done on time. I want to first ask Maria to take our role. Maria?
Boy. Good afternoon, everyone. Judge Conklin.
I'm present.
Finke.
I'm here.
Judge Clark. Judge Clark. I'll see her. We'll come back. Judge Jessner. Okay, Judge Kamakarian.
We have anybody?
Judge Kelly.
I'm here.
Miss Cameron.
Here.
Mr. Chatters.
I am here.
Miss Fleming.
She said she'd be a little bit late.
Okay. Mr. Slayton.
I'm here.
Miss Turner
Here.
and Mr. Yamasaki.
Yes, good afternoon, President.
Maria, thanks so much. And again, welcome everybody. We'll just take care of a few ministerial tasks. And the first in is the approval of the minutes from the October 9th, 2025 FMS meeting. Those are in your materials. I'd invite a motion to approve.
Turner moves approval. Well, I'll second.
Moved and seconded that the minutes from that meeting be approved. Is there any opposition from the FMS members present to that approval? And hearing none nor any abstentions, I'll deem the minutes approved unanimously by those members present. We're now going to move to our public comment, and I'm going to turn it over to Chad to administer the public comment portion. Chad?
Thanks, Judge. So I think, as the members of the committee know, remote public comment is now an available option for our FMS meetings and provides members of the public with the opportunity to speak on agenda items. Today's meeting, including the public comments, is live streamed and the recording will be publicly available online. I'll begin by calling the remote speakers. Typically, each speaker would have up to 2 minutes to present their comments. And what I would normally do is ask the speakers when their name is called to please turn on the camera, unmute their mic, and begin by stating their name and, if applicable, their title and affiliation. We will have a timer up on the screen to track your allotted time, and we would ask that you please begin your concluding remarks when you see 20 seconds left. And I'm about to introduce our first speaker, but I also understand that that Ms. Heimov may have a request to sort of speak collectively. So I will introduce Leslie Heimov, but then I'll let us know how you would like to handle the four speakers.
We appreciate that very much. Yeah, there are again four of us speaking on the Dependency Council item, and we would like to go in order of Amanda and then Julia and then Sabrina and then myself. And if we and we may not all we have sort of a combined 8 minutes, so if we can do it that way, that would be ideal.
Understood. So then we will start by calling Amanda Kennedy, the managing attorney of the East Bay Children's Law Offices.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Amanda Kennedy, and I'm the managing attorney of East Bay Children's Law Offices in Oakland. We have the contract to represent children and non-minor dependents in Alameda County. And prior to joining EBCLO, I represented children in Santa Clara County with legal advocates for children and youth. I'm first going to address the initial question raised in the report to the subcommittee, which is whether any changes should be implemented as to the calculation of child caseload with regard to the rolling 3-year average calculation. At this point, we believe that more time is needed to analyze this issue. However, we would ask the committee to consider implementing caps on percentage change in funding in any given year. This would serve as a guardrail for programs in counties that experience steep fluctuations in case filings over any 3-year period. Briefly, we can use Santa Clara County as an example. In 2021 to 2023, Santa Clara experienced sharp declines in new filings, which resulted in a decrease in funding. However, the county then experienced steep increases in filings. So at the same time, the funding was lowered as the workload was sharply increasing, and that mismatch makes it extremely difficult for providers to maintain adequate staffing and cover their overhead costs. The second question I'll address is whether the ratio to estimate parent clients should continue to be calculated using a 0.8 multiplier relative to child cases. And the answer is no. At the time the ratio was incorporated into the methodology, it was an estimate. But we no longer have to rely on an educated guess because we have actual data that we can use to determine the number of parent clients in relationship to child clients. And I will now defer to Julia Hannigan.
Thank you, Amanda, and thank you, members of this committee, for your time. My name is Julie Hannigan, and I am the Director of Policy and Prevention with Dependency Legal Services. Our organization represents parents and children in child welfare cases in six counties. As outlined in the report, the nature of child welfare practice has changed in the past decade, and the caseload standard must conform to the needs of current practitioners. As such, 141 cases is too high. Our lawyers are not simply reviewing reports and attending juvenile court hearings anymore. Instead, we are preparing for, attending, and doing follow-up for IEP meetings, CFT meetings, drug court hearings, psychotropic medication reviews, and staffings. To meet the complicated needs of our clients, our organization and many others around the state have instituted multidisciplinary teams in line with best practices from the American Bar Association and National Association of Counsel for Children to provide holistic representation. These teams have been proven effective at reducing time in care and length of cases, but this type of work requires our attorneys and social workers to navigate the many systems, mental health, housing, even the DMV, that pose barriers to reunification. Our lawyers are calling Medi-Cal to unravel a parent's denial and contacting NGOs in foreign countries to utilize new relative placement protections. This work helps families, but this work takes time. Our lawyers are proud of these advances in our practices and grateful for the expanded protections for our clients. For example, now our minor clients cannot be placed in an STRTP without an expert opinion in a hearing. But all these increased protections are meaningless without an opportunity for our attorneys to review these findings, advise our clients, and prepare for these hearings. There are not enough hours in the day to meet these new standards for 141 clients, and a deferral of this issue for another case study would not be helpful to our current families and their lawyers. Both the ABA and NACC have workload standards that could easily be applied to California. We know what best practices in dependency attorneys look like, and it cannot be done with a single attorney trying to meet the needs of 141 clients. Thank you for your time.
My name is Zabrina Alaguire. Thank you for adding to this year's work plan the important issue of dependency attorney funding. I work for the Bar Association of San Francisco, where I manage the court-appointed dependency attorney program. All of our attorneys are independent contractors who go through a rigorous process to become qualified and approved by our court to serve on our dependency panel. Our attorneys who represent children and their parents in San Francisco are among the most dedicated, talented, and wise people I know. Most of them have done this work for over three decades, and yet most of our attorneys earn less than half of a county council's salary. As independent contractors, they must cover their own overhead and benefits. By comparison, their counterparts at county council are full-time employees with pensions, paralegals, and administrative assistants, and more built-in support than I can quickly list in 2 minutes. It is time to more highly compensate our court-appointed dependency counsel. While the CAC funding methodology only uses level one and two of county council salaries, the reality in San Francisco is that almost all of the government attorneys are at level 16 or close behind. We request that this part of the funding formula be revised to more properly compensate our attorneys who make this their life's work. Better compensation would help us with retaining talent, as dependency providers across the state regularly lose attorneys to county council because of the stark pay difference. Better compensation will also help us recruit attorneys to this extremely challenging area of law. We are here to partner with you to recommend adjustments to the funding formula that promote equity and fairness. In addition to revising the county council salary, we wish to examine how the BLS Category 92 index figures into the formula. We believe that our participation in a work group with your subcommittee would provide a beneficial forum to work through these details and others spoken to by my colleagues here today.
Lastly, we recognize that the Judicial Council is anxious to conduct a workload assessment prior to setting a revised maximum caseload. However, even with funding requested in the BCP, it will be several years from inception to completion, and neither the attorneys doing the work, the families we serve today, nor the court should have to wait for long overdue relief. We recommend that the committee adopt an interim reduced caseload standard and that staff work with the dependency providers to identify a more reasonable interim number. For the remaining items in the report, overhead calculation and small courts, we're not prepared today to comment on the specific percentages set aside or other metrics, but we do encourage the committee to consider additional factors that may not have been uplifted in the prior analyses. Regarding the small and smallest courts, the exception has consumed the rule, resulting in a handful of large and I would say medium courts bearing an inequitable burden of the small court adjustments. The committee should reconsider the definition of small and smallest, and while those courts will have certain adjustments, the path to the set aside should be revisited. The concept of economies of scale, while valid, does not recognize that there are also costs associated with being a large or medium-sized county, which offset the economies of scale. One example which has a ripple effect is the need to staff dependency courtrooms in multiple courthouses in the same county and potentially house staff in multiple locations. Lastly, we urge the committee to consider how to better allocate the up to $30 million gap in funding, which has been in the budget since fiscal year 22. Each year, approximately half of that gap funding is returned to the general fund. There are a number of ways that funding could be partially restructured. In conclusion, the work this committee is embarking upon has the potential for a positive impact even beyond the annual reallocation. Our ability to advocate, whether it is this year or in future years, for an increase to the overall budget depends on a fair projection of need. Under the current methodology, there is a counterproductive and damaging perception that dependency councils are fully funded. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much to each of our speakers. We appreciate your comments. We certainly appreciate how organized you are and how timely. Thank you very much. You certainly can continue to view the remainder of the meeting at the web link that hopefully you all received by email. And I believe that now concludes our public comment, Judge Conklin.
Yeah, thanks so much. And to the four of you, thank you. Very efficient, very effective, and it's appreciated by all our members. So now we're going to turn to our discussion items today. We have several on today's agenda, many action items and a few information items. Excuse me, we'll be considering a recommendation to repeal the trial court minimum operating and emergency fund balance policy. There's two items related to specific allocations, and then there's an informational item that will provide updates on other items on the subcommittee's annual work plan. So the first item we're going to turn to this afternoon, is just that, the trial court minimum operating and emergency fund balance policy. This is an action item. We're about to hear from Alexana by a way of brief introduction. I remind committee members, this is a policy that's been suspended for the past 14 years due to statutory changes. Not that it wasn't an effective policy at the time, but the original intent of the policy was to establish a set aside for trial courts to use in emergency situations for revenue shortages or budgetary imbalances. Since this first suspension in 2012-2013, other options have been established to support the trial courts in the event of funding shortfalls, unforeseen emergencies, or unanticipated expenses. So with that brief introduction, I'm going to turn it over to Oksana to give us some detail on this before I ask for action. Oksana?
Thank you, Judge Conklin. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Oksana Tak, and I'm a senior analyst with Budget Services. I'm presenting today on agenda item number one, trial court minimum operating and emergency fund balance policy, found in your materials beginning on page 6. This is a Judicial Council approved policy which directs trial courts to maintain an emergency fund balance or a reserve of 5% of the first 10 million in expenditures, scaling down to 3% of expenditures over 50 million. This policy that is displayed in attachment A on pages 10 through 14 was first established in fiscal year 2006-2007 to ensure that a reserve funding was set aside for use in emergency situations or when revenue shortfalls or budgetary imbalances might occur. The policy has been continuously suspended by the Council in two-year increments beginning in fiscal year 2012-13 in response to advocacy efforts by the judicial branch to increase the fund balance cap for the trial courts and due to the several legislative changes in statute affecting courts' fund balances. Those changes include the establishment of a 2% state-level reserve and a 1% cap on trial court fund balances. Sequentially, the 2% state-level reserve was replaced with a 10 million state-level reserve in trial court trust fund, known as TCTF, to provide emergency funding for the trial courts. In fiscal year 2019-20, the fund balance cap for trial court was increased from 1% to 3% of the court's operating budget from the prior fiscal year. And most recently, in fiscal year 24-25, Assembly Bill 170 reduced the trial court state-level emergency reserve in TCTF from 10 million to 5 million. Currently, there are several funding options available to trial courts to assist with funding shortfalls, unforeseen emergencies, or unanticipated expenses for existing programs or operations. These funding options include the previously mentioned state-level reserve of 5 million, cash advances, and the use of statutory restricted funds to cover short-term financial needs. These options provide flexibility to the trial courts and negate the need for the continuation of the minimum operating and emergency fund balance policy. Additionally, the Council approved the fund held on behalf of the trial courts program, which is an important fiscal tool that allow trial court to fund necessary projects and purchases and meet contractual obligations within their limited resources. This process maximizes available resources, especially given the fund balance cap and the recent budget reductions. So the trial court minimum operating and emergency fund balance policy has become obsolete over time, given the alternative options available for courts in emergency situations and the revenue shortages. After suspending the policy for 14 consecutive years, a repeal of the policy is proposed for consideration. The action must be taken before June 30th, 2026, when this current suspension of the policy will expire. The proposed recommendation for policy repeal is located on page 9 of the meeting materials. It will be considered by the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee, the Judicial Branch Budget Committee, and then the Judicial Council at its April 2026 business meeting. That concludes our presentation today, and we're happy to take any questions you might have. Thank you.
Oksana, thank you so much. So before we turn to a proposed vote on this, are there any discussions or questions of Oksana? David, your hands up. Go ahead, Yamasaki, and you're muted. There you go.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Oksana, for sharing us with us the information and some of the history that we have on this particular item. One of the things that you identified for courts to have in terms of being able to set aside resources for situations, we'll call it, was FHLB funds held on behalf of. Is that money available to be reverted back to a court's general fund in the event of emergency, or is the intent of FHLB to be used for specifically identified projects?
Yeah, it is specifically identifiable projects. So whatever was indicated in the application that court initially submitted for the council approval and that was approved, that's supposed to be used for. If there are any amendments that court needs to implement, then it has to go through the amendment process again with approval by the council.
Got it.
So we've had discussions through FPS on that exact process, David, as you know, with the amendments that gives some flexibility to courts to amend their FHLB to address other ongoing issues.
I just wanted to make sure that we had a full understanding collectively on how that process works, how the money moves, and the mechanism in place to make those sorts of adjustments. One of the reasons why I was bringing up this particular question is I do think that maintaining a minimum fund balance is a best practice for us. Going back to the pandemic, hopefully we don't revisit a similar situation such as that. But we turn to those resources in our fund balance to quickly reopen our doors. And that money burned through very quickly because of some of the things that we had to implement to ensure that our facilities remain safe. A lot of uncertainty. We had to have people work remotely. In those instances, we had to spend our reserves. And we used those resources precisely for one of the descriptions that has been set aside for even having the recommended best practice in place, and that is to address contingencies. And so I recognize, and that in fact, I've even voted to support suspending this for a number of occasions, but I still think that having it in place is absolutely a best practice for us. It's very evident with the budget reductions that we've experienced and some of the cost increases that it's difficult for us to hit that minimum target. But notwithstanding that, I do think that it is a important mechanism that we should all strive to maintain in the event that we have an emergency. If all of us have an emergency at the same time, the available resources to turn to, I think, would be difficult to sufficiently fund some of the things that we have going on. And I recognize that the alternative is to perhaps, if it's not repealed altogether, that we would be looking at spending it, which is fine with me. But I think as a collective, it's important for us to try to set money aside and as much as we can and we're permitted to, because of those emergencies that are unforeseen and could be very devastating. So that's one of the reasons why I think that maintaining it, even in a suspended status, would be reasonable and appropriate. Thanks.
All right, thanks, David. Jake, I see your hand up too.
Yeah, thank you, Judge. I'm going to partially echo what David just said, and then I'm going to add a little bit. So I think my ultimate comment would be that I would encourage us to look at the policy and potentially revise it so that it is useful. I agree with David, having some guidance to courts and suggestion to maintain a minimum level of fund balance, which obviously can't be 3% today since that's a cap. But I think giving some guidance to courts on having some level of local reserve is important. The comment that David brought up about the funds held on behalf, like, yes, that's a way for courts to work with the Judicial Council on longer term projects, but it doesn't address the emergency nature of having a emergency fund balance. I mean, that's not what those funds are for. The system isn't built to respond quickly in the event of an actual, emergency. Sometimes it isn't an emergency. Sometimes it's a surprise expense. Some vendor comes back, as a number of us have had this year, on technology items that, suddenly that assumed, 10% increase on some cost came back 25%, when I wish I was exaggerating. Probably am a little, but you need to have some ability to respond to those things. And I've been out of this committee long enough that I don't remember. And maybe there could be clarification on what can a court do. If they suddenly think they're falling $100,000 short for the year, what is the process for them if they didn't have a fund balance? And so knowing that would be helpful. But even with that, I think it's important to us to convey some level of fiscal necessity at a local level to have a minimum fund balance to address minor fluctuations or emergencies. So I understand we've had it suspended for, over a decade. I remember the first vote on it. I think, like David, I think I was probably there. I think I voted for it as a suspension. And obviously we can't have it as currently written since we can't hold that much in fund balance. But I think revising it is more appropriate than repealing it. I'd add that I think that's also important that, the trial court trust fund is a big fund. And, having the ability for the TCTF to keep a $5 million balance is pretty small. Like, that is not a lot of leeway in that fund. I can remember times in the past where there was a lot of discussion about, the amount of fund balance in the TCTF getting too low, and it was higher than 5 million, higher than 10 million, even at those times, if I remember right. So I think that's another element. Like, there is not the ability for JCC to keep as much money on that fund balance either. So I think all those together, a revision, in my opinion, would be more appropriate than a repeal.
All right. Thanks very much, Jake. And David, I see your Slayton, I see your hand up too.
Yes, just a maybe a question. I don't know if this is for Oksana or someone else, but do we know today or as of the end of last fiscal year what percentage or how many trial courts have money in their fund balance of a significant amount? Does anyone know that?
Yeah, I don't. Maybe if Oksana can look it up, but David, to your question, there are courts that hit the 3%, and there's courts that don't, and so it's not a uniformity that they're all maximizing their 3%. As you know, in fact, that this committee approved fund balance adjustments for those that are above. So it varies, and it can change based on the fiscal circumstances, obviously,
Sure.
from year to year. So it's hard to identify a pattern, but you're gonna have 58 courts and 58 scenarios.
I guess maybe my question the other way is the other way, which is, are there any that have zero?
We've had times where some courts have gotten pretty low. We've had a couple over the course of the years that have had a end of the year with a negative fund balance, but then have taken actions to bring that into balance as they head into the next fiscal year. But it's not been a position where there's been this persistent fiscal sort of emergency. And to Jake's point, there are tools that the report does describe in terms of the emergency fund. There is a form that is available on our system to make those requests that then get considered, at least for the emergency fund, through the JBBC and a committee that looks at those. There are cash advances that often help folks as they have low fund balances. And you know that we do the front loading of the allocations at the beginning of the fiscal year, as well as do our cash flow request in June to see who needs early allocation. So there, and then there's obviously the FHOB for project specific issues. So there are a lot of tools. Definitely the way that the language is written now, it doesn't work mathematically. When you have 3, 4, and 5%, those aren't even amounts that courts can hold.
Right.
And so, I mean, the concept of some level of I think policy is what you're discussing. And our recommendation, at least to the option that's been brought before you, is to eliminate it, given that folks have all the tools otherwise, and best practices, though, are also important. I don't know if I've
Sorry, just one more question, if I might. You hit the one question I was going to ask, which is, I think Jake had mentioned, obviously, what's listed here is not possible if someone, because they'd be go over their fund balance cap statutorily. But if this, even if we were to revise it to say 2% of whatever your expenditures were, which would be within that, and this policy were to go into effect, in the past, has it been that In other words, would courts that don't have that have to meet that basically immediately? So like in next fiscal year, they'd have to figure out a way to get the 2% into their fund. How's that been handled in the past? Or maybe
it really hasn't. I mean, but once it was suspended, it was, there were courts, you know, that year to year might have had an issue, but generally speaking, courts held the average statewide fund balance at the time that the fund balance cap was put into place was between 20 and 22%. But that didn't account for things that we've adjusted for, like encumbrances and other things. So it's hard to necessarily get it, but we had a half a billion dollars of funds from an accounting gap standpoint, you know, there. But we have a state legal basis accounting. So we're extracting certain things from the standard kind of push. But yeah, I think there's always been this concern of a court getting into fiscal concerns about what are the actions that come by not meeting that policy. And there has been, and it's been not since I've been here, where a court went into what was considered fiscal receivership, in which, you know, court had intervention by counsel to help bring about changes to their operations to bring them in balance. But when the Great Recession occurred, there were some loans that were provided. And then there was a group of CEOs that went to that court and helped look at their operations to help them balance their budget. So there's been a variety over the years of efforts to support, you know, what are the consequences. As it says right now in the policy, let's just say that if you go below those, you're supposed to notify folks immediately. But those could be temporal, right? As cash flows come up and down, you know, where one might land. So to the extent that there's a desire to move in some sort of policy, we'd want to make sure that it is real to today's circumstances and not what happened 5 and 10 years after the Child Core Funding Act was in place. And there was still a lot of instability. And I'm sorry, I've been-
Chad's got his hand up. Thanks, Lachlan, for that clarification, Chad.
Thanks, Judge. So I think my questions, David Slayton, kind of got to them, which is I just was trying to figure out for people who were around when this policy was in effect, which I wasn't. I just am struggling to understand mechanically how it would work, because the language that is currently on pause says that you have to maintain the minimum operating and emergency fund balance at all times during a fiscal year. Right. So you can't even dip down into it, you know, because as we all know, right, we get unexpected revenues, we have unexpected expenses, and you hope at the end of the year you land. And I guess the other thing I'm trying to figure out is if it's there for, maybe I'm missing it, but if an emergency does come up, where's the language that says, well, now we can go below it because an emergency, like it just seems like it's just this permanent ongoing haircut that we all have to take to our budget that we can't ever dip below. So I guess at most, I think I would support amending this language. I mean, just pausing it for, it seems so anachronistic to me that just pausing it for another year, I don't know that I could get behind that, but maybe relooking at it in light of the new budget landscape maybe makes sense. But I would hope if we do that, that we sort of focus on, you know, you should end the year with some minimum fund balance, as opposed to, you know, thou shalt not dip below a certain level at any time in the midst of a fiscal year. I just don't know that that's possible.
Yeah, I'm not a CEO, so I don't have anywhere near the perspective or the expertise that you do, but just from a, even though it's been many years outside looking in, I have the same concerns, especially when I appreciate how all you have commented on this, but we haven't used it for 14 years. So I would consider the same thing, taking it off the books and then perhaps coming up with a new one that might be more effective. But to keep it going after 14 years of literally not touching it, as I understand it.
Judge, I did. That makes sense, most definitely. I mean, and it might be that, as David Yamasaki started with, this as a best practice, we should convene a group to talk about it if the committee's will is to revisit it rather than eliminate it. And then address the practical realities of today's fiscal management if the desire is to not simply just eliminate it, but rather recast it, revise it, refresh it.
All right, and I see Judge Clark's hand up. I'm going to go there, but then remind everybody we got quite a few more items to get through, and we're already to 12:35. So one option might be to, for lack of a better option, table this and bring it back up again when we can revisit it. But Judge Clark, did you have a comment?
Well, I was just going to suggest that we look at, rather than just rescinding this policy, because then we have to start over again as to whether we adopt a policy at all. Instead, that we look at adding this to the workflow, not for the 2026 year, but for the following year, and we just suspend it and then have a working group to look at amending it in that period of time.
Yeah, the only, and I don't know if Zlatko or Oksana can help me with this, but doesn't this expire in June of 26? So will that force us to do something before that time if we don't
eliminate it? Judge Clark has suggested, which is suspend it, but also then at the end of that additional 2-year suspension, have a policy prepared and adopted before that suspension is up, which can happen before the end of the 2 years, but you can act to suspend it now, but then with the referral to a committee, subcommittee of this group, to work on refining the policy at a future date.
So we're currently suspended through June. So yes, we would act to date us for another 2-year suspension to June of 28. And then we would use that window to decide whether or not we want to continue to suspend and suspend or develop a new policy.
Yeah, we could do that.
David Yamasaki?
I was only going to suggest, I think we can land on a solution that everybody could be comfortable with. I don't know that the language needs to be complicated, but I don't know how quickly we can convene and put together some language to everybody's satisfaction. But I would hate for us to let this linger 2 more years, and maybe we can extend it 1 at the most, and then with the intent of revising it, because I'm very supportive of revising some of the language. The way it reads right now, we can't comply with it. So even if we said, well, let's make it 3%, we can't comply with that either. It would have to be suspended again anyway. So it seems to me that if we were to just extend, if you would entertain a motion for us to simply suspend this practice or rule, I can't remember what it is, for 1 year, and giving us an opportunity to craft language with additional input from others on the final language going forward.
And that would be to June of, so David, so your motion is specific. You would move to, and I don't mean to put words in your mouth, resuspend or continue the suspension of this policy until June of 2026.
Yes.
2027, pardon me. It's 2026 right now.
27, yes.
Okay. Is there a, Chad, I saw your thumbs up. Is there a second to that?
I'll second that. This is Jake.
Who was that? David?
Jake.
Chatters.
Chad, Jake. Okay. So moved and seconded that rather than eliminating the, as is currently recommended, that we suspend for an additional year from June of 26 to June of 27, the minimum operating and emergency fund balance policy. It's moved and seconded.
Well, I would say, Judge, I think on top of that is, in order to allow time to look at revising the policy.
Right. So we would add it. Let's just be thorough. We would add it to the FMS work plan for that time period to consider revising the policy.
Yes.
All right. So that's the motion that David Yamasaki has made and Chad has seconded with that additional language.
Jake has seconded.
Sorry, I've seen too many things on the screen. Yamasaki moved, Chatter seconded. I think Finke gave a thumbs up at some point. With that, any further discussion? And is there any opposition to the motion as understood and seconded? Hearing none, I'll deem that motion unanimously approved. All right. So now we're going to move to item two, and I'm going to preface this with, and I let Chad know about this, so this is not a surprise. I've got a hard stop just at one at about 12:50 or 12:55 for me. I've got another court obligation that I have to start right at one. So Chad's going to take over at that time. But now we're going to move to the mid-year reallocation for pretrial release program. We're about to hear from Deidre on this. This is to consider exactly that, a mid-year reallocation of unspent funds for pretrial release. You are all familiar with us reallocating funds for other issues. In this case, by reallocating funds that can't be used by some courts, they can be made available to other courts to utilize fully and appropriately for their pretrial services, pretrial release program. We don't have a specified methodology at this time, so I'm going to turn to Deidre to detail that and present the item. Deidre?
Thank you, Judge Conklin, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm Deirdre Benedict. I'm the supervising analyst for the pretrial release program, and this is item two. It's pages 16 to 33 in your materials. And yes, this is a reallocation mid-year. In September of 25, the Judicial Council approved the 25-26 allocations, but they directed staff to conduct a mid-year survey and recommend a methodology for reallocating funding. 25-26 is the first year that the legislation includes language that allows the Judicial Council to reallocate funding. So we did a survey. Staff did a survey to all courts in mid-November, and of that, 23 courts responded that they would not be returning nor requesting additional funding. We had 24 courts that requested additional funding that amounted to $12.2 million. And we had one court that was willing to return funding in the amount of $194,000. So having little to look at reallocating, staff took a first cut and looked at those courts that had requested more than $194,000 and took them out of the pot. That was 13 courts requested less than that amount. We then followed up with those courts and asked them to provide a detailed narrative about what the funds would be used for, how they could be used within this fiscal year. We then also looked at their budgets. We looked at the reduction and their percent in spending. We wanted to make sure the funding was going to courts that could spend it within the year. So we have a couple of recommendations, and it's certainly open to any other thoughts by the subcommittee. But our recommendation from staff would be to reallocate the funding based on the smaller requests and fulfill the most complete request that is possible with the $194,000 that would be returned. This would enable us to fund five courts direct a full request, and they are detailed on page 18 and 19 in the memo. And then it would be a partial funding of the sixth court, 55% that court would receive. We think that would be the best way to make use of the funding, but we could also reallocate the funding among all the courts that requested, the 24 courts, that would become about $8,000 each court would receive. So that is laid out in the table two. You'll see option two on page 20 of your materials. We also looked at, we know that when we sent out a request, we sent out both a request to return money and to ask for money. And at that point in time, we had no idea what funds were available for reallocation. So now that we know the amount, another possibility might be to recirculate the request to all courts, knowing we have $194,000. But when we looked at the timeline required in order to reallocate the funding before the end of this fiscal year, it did not seem a practical option. So staff is recommending option one, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thanks so much. So again, just to summarize, that sort of the thought that went into all this was, let's get the biggest bang for the buck. I don't mean to oversimplify it, but we could satisfy 5.5 courts full requests. Otherwise, we could get all of you $8,000, which administratively, I don't know what you do with that. So I'm not trying to tip my hand, but I think the recommendation to make effective use of this to those courts that can simply use it and satisfy their full request is a good one. But I want to open it up for discussion or questions of Deidre. David Slayton.
Thanks, Judge Conklin, and thanks for your comment just now. I don't have a good solution to this, except to say I think I don't personally love the way that this option one allocation goes. I don't like allocation number two either, because it's not meaningful enough. You know, it seems if the way that we allocate funds is to say, well, whose can we meet, and they get the full funding, it just seems like a bad policy decision. That being said, I'm not sure what alternative is available for us, and so I'm not suggesting an alternative or saying I would vote against it. But I wish if we could think about this for future years, I would like to see if there was a different way, because it just seems like there's some courts on here that have needs that are maybe just right above that that are going to get nothing. It just seems like not a great way to distribute the funds. So I don't have a solution. Maybe somebody else on the committee does, but I just wanted to express that I think option one is not a way we should be doing this. I just don't have an alternative.
Great. Thanks. Kim Turner?
So David Slayton stole my thunder and said exactly what I would say, which is I don't think this is a great way to allocate this very tiny amount of money when the need is so great, to just say, well, you know, these five courts, you know, came in with small requests, so we'll just fully fund them. I mean, I agree also, Judge Conklin, that sending $8,000 to however many courts were on the list for additional funds here seems crazy. I mean, the paperwork alone is going to eat up the $8,000 in each and every case. But I would like to, I know I'm kind of a broken record, but I would like to go back to comments that I've made in earlier TICBAC meetings about revisiting the entire allocation formula, because we have tiny courts that are getting, you know, $200,000 a year, although this year, I guess everyone got $185,500 if they were in that category. And those range from two judge courts to 10 judge courts. So, you know, Alpine County is getting the same amount of money as Mendocino County. And I'm not trying to pick on Alpine County, but, you know, their population is, you know, under 2,000 people. Mine is 100,000 people. We're getting the same amount of money. So I think I think we really need to consider looking at this, you know, whether we do this thing today. I'm not going to fight it if it turns out that, you know, funding under option one is the way to go. That's okay, because there isn't enough money to really even, you know, fight about at this point. But I would like us to take a look at why we have set the floor at $200,000 for every court. I just think that seems, in my humble opinion, to be, it just isn't the best way to allocate this money.
Thanks, Kim. Chad?
Thanks. Just a quick question for Deirdre. So one of the potential options, Deirdre, you identified was, now that we know the amount is $194,000, to do a resurvey. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered if you have... I sort of share some of the concerns that folks have raised about, you know, well, we're just sort of picking people we can fully fund. But I'm also worried about timing, right? And so if you did a resurvey, I'm just curious if you have any thoughts as to like what that timeline would look like, because I wonder if that's truly a viable option. If that's going to take another few months, are we going to be getting money to people too late to even spend?
Right. Thank you, Chad, for raising that. The sort of the trajectory we're on now has us bringing these recommendations to the council in April, which is only 2 months before the end of the fiscal year. So any delay is going to push it to a point where we won't be able to do it. We have to do the reallocation within the fiscal year. Of course, we could look at a circulating order process with the Judicial Council. So I'm not saying it's impossible, but in terms of sending out the requests to the courts, giving them time to respond, creating the recommendation, it would be really tight.
Jake, your hands up. Thanks, Deidre.
Yeah. So, you know, Judge, if you're ready, I mean, I would hold my nose and make a recommendation at this point. I agree with, you know, what David Slayton said to kick it off, and others have agreed. I really don't like the policy behind saying, well, we can fund these because they're smaller amounts, but we really don't have enough to allocate to do something different. I was even looking quickly at like, well, what if you funded 50% of each of the requests? But, you know, Plumas getting $4,000 doesn't really make sense, right? So then you get into the, well, if it, you know, half minimum of up to $50,000, and then it's 50% or something. But even then, you're adding two more courts, which I don't think substantially makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. So I would just want to say I would move to adopt staff's recommendation of option one, but would say that that is not precedence setting, and that it's due to, timing this first year and the small amount available. Because I agree, I don't like it as a method, but I think it's probably the best we have with the time we have and the money available. So my motion would be to adopt staff's recommendation of option one, as a one-time reallocation method, and that it not be a precedent-setting process.
And I'll second that just to move the discussion along. I appreciate everybody's concern, but I don't think this sets policy. I think this is an example of an efficient use of funds one time to address needs that can be fully covered. I appreciate everybody's comments. I think we can take a look at this. And as Kim said, maybe we can even go deeper and figure out a better way to reallocate in general. But for this time, these purposes, and the time left, I'm seconding Jake's motion, and I'll open it up for discussion or further discussion.
Judge Conklin, can I say something very quickly?
Sure.
Okay. I just wanted to say I hear all of you, and I think staff shares the same assessment. This is not a methodology we would want to use going forward, but given the very, very small of funds we have available and the great need, this seemed like the way to really make an impact on the courts that really need us. So we agree. I agree with you, and we would not do this going forward.
Okay. And I am told as a side note that we have all our committee members now present. And so generally, my practice is to say, anybody say no, but I think out of respect to all the positions here, I'm just gonna ask Maria to take a voice vote individually on the, and so it's been moved and seconded that staff recommendation as proposed is adopted. And Maria, can you take a individual vote on that, please?
Judge Conklin?
Yes.
Mr. Finke?
Yes, excuse me.
Judge Clark?
Yes.
Judge Jessner? Judge Jessner?
She said she joined us.
Was. Okay, Judge Komakarian?
Here.
Is that a yes, David, or a no?
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Judge Kelly?
Yes.
Ms. Cameron?
Yes.
Mr. Chatters?
Yes.
Ms. Fleming?
Yes.
Mr. Slayton?
Yes.
Ms. Turner?
Yes.
And Mr. Yamasaki?
Yes.
Okay. Let's see. Judge Jessner?
Yes. Sorry. Yes. I got cut off.
Okay.
All right. Thanks all so much. And I know you know I didn't mean this. I didn't mean to say, let's just jam this through. But I was just voicing my opinion. I'm sure everybody voted their own conscience. I appreciate that. We'll show that the recommendation is approved for this year, but this year alone. So I do agree that as you've all very appropriately suggested, we take a deeper dive on this as we move forward. Jake has just stated he has a court commitment, and so do I. That still leaves us with a quorum, and as pre-planned, and I'm sorry, but I'm told I cannot miss this event, and I don't want to offend anybody. So I'm now going to turn it over to Chad to conclude the meeting with thanks to all of you. It's the end of the year. I'll take a moment before I have to step out, but I so appreciate everything you've all done. It's the end of the year only. That doesn't mean anything except to say we're about to start 2026. And I'm so glad you're all along for this ride, and for the comments you've made to me personally. I really appreciate it. So it's a great group. I enjoy this so much, and I'm not going anywhere, even though, as you all know, I'm transitioning into retirement. The chief's been gracious enough to allow me to continue on with this committee and another for some time to come. So have a great new year. Great Christmas, great holiday, and can't help myself, as I said before, go Dodgers. So thanks all.
Same to you, sir.
Yep. And Chad, you're in charge.
Thanks, Judge. All right. So our next item is to consider recommending updates to the approved Judicial Council funding methodology for court-appointed juvenile dependency counsel, as you heard our public speakers say, to address challenges faced by the trial courts and improve outcomes in the dependency system. In September, the council approved the fiscal year 25-26 allocations for court-appointed juvenile dependency counsel and directed TICBAC to add an additional item to its fiscal year 25-26 work plan to consider a revised methodology, excuse me. Our work plan was then updated in October to include this item. Reevaluation of the methodology is in response to the concerns raised by stakeholders in the courts that the existing methodology may no longer meet the needs of the program to support juvenile dependency proceedings, again, as we heard a little earlier. And so I'm now going to turn it over to Kelly Milab, supervising analyst at CFCC, to present the item. I saw Kelly. Hope she's still here. Nope. Audrey's going to take it.
Yes, I don't know what happened to Kelly, and hopefully, I think she just rejoined.
There she is.
Sorry, I froze for just a second. My apologies. Thank you, Mr. Finke and members of FMS. I'm Kelly Milab, supervising analyst with the Center for Families, Children, and the Courts. And as Mr. Finke mentioned, for today, we are presenting the court-appointed juvenile dependency counsel funding methodology, which was approved by the Judicial Council in 2016 and amended most recently in 2022. Again, as Mr. Finke stated, during the budget development process for fiscal year 25-26, stakeholders did raise concerns that the existing allocation methodology may no longer address the realities of juvenile dependency practice. The key factors that are used in the current methodology are for each court, caseloads calculated using original dependency filings, child welfare caseloads, and to estimate and incorporate parent clients, a set ratio of 0.8 parent cases per one child case. Another factor used is the caseload standard of 141 cases per full-time attorney. This standard was based on a workload study published in 2004. And as noted in the report, since then, there have been several changes to federal and state laws that impact juvenile dependency practice and dependency attorney workload. In addition, as also noted in the report, the Judicial Council developed a budget change proposal for support to conduct a workload assessment that was approved for submission to the Department of Finance for fiscal year 26-27. Another factor used is attorney salaries, which are based on current county council salaries at the median of the first two salary ranges reported by counties and the Bureau of Labor Statistics current index that is used in the workload formula. The methodology also includes an overhead calculation where attorney salaries constitute 45% of the total cost and non-salary costs constitute 55% of the total cost. And finally, for small courts, the methodology includes $100,000 in reserve funding to assist small courts with the cost of sharp caseload increases and several adjustments to ensure that small courts have adequate funding to meet their needs. The small court adjustments include suspending reallocation related budget reductions for the smallest courts with caseloads under 200, adjusting the local economic index for the small courts with dependency caseloads under 400, and reducing funding allocations of all large court budgets to offset the cost for small courts. The methodology does also provide that if the impact of these adjustments results in a small court being allocated more than 100% of the total need calculated through the methodology, the court will receive an allocation equal to 100% of their total need. For reference, the detailed calculation of total funding need for fiscal year 25-26, which utilizes these key factors, is detailed in attachment 3A on page 33 of your materials. The report also includes questions for each of the methodology factors to guide discussion. Staff are requesting that FMS consider and provide direction regarding updates to the factors used in the current court-appointed dependency counsel funding methodology to address the unique challenges faced by local trial courts, and whether there are elements of other funding methodologies that should be considered to appropriately and effectively allocate dependency counsel funding. And that concludes my presentation. I'm happy to answer questions at this time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kelly. Before we open it up, one thing I wanted to let the group know is, I mean, as you just heard Kelly mention and you heard our speakers talk about, I mean, this is a pretty meaty issue, right? I mean, it's fairly complicated and in-depth. So one thing Judge Conklin and I talked about as a possible action item or a possible step forward would be we as the co-chairs of FMS could appoint a working group to really do kind of a deep dive on this. So I wanted to just throw that out there as a potential option for folks to think about. Certainly if people have strong feelings right now about ways the model could and or should be amended, we can talk about that as well. But I did just want everybody to know that there is sort of the work group option, which could then bring any recommended changes back to this group to have a more robust discussion. So with that, I will stop talking and turn it to David Slate.
Thanks, Chad, and appreciate you starting with that. I was curious how we were going to address this big issue in the, 30 minutes we have left. Kelly will know, because she and I have had several conversations about this. I think this formula needs a lot of work. So I'm really excited to hear that there's a willingness, and I hope that FMS as a group will support a work group, because I think it's going to take a lot of work to get to the bottom of this, because as our public commenters spoke today and have spoken repeatedly over the last couple of years that I've been on TickBack, I think there's some pretty serious problems. One of the ones that I've noted that really raises as a big concern for me and was noted by one of the public commenters is serious fluctuations from year to year in allocations. And so, you know, obviously one of the things that we for our own selves at the trial court level try to do is to have stability and predictability. But if you look at the allocations to the various programs, that is not at all what our current formula does. And so I think it's worth us taking a look at that, because at the end of the day, these are providers who are hiring staff to do this. These are not, most of them not hiring contractors, they're hiring staff to do that. So that means letting people go or doing other, having to hold positions open that presumably would be used to assist children. So I think that's a huge issue that we need to address. I know we're gonna address this in the work group, but just a couple of other things, if you'll all indulge me for a second here. You know, with regard to the caseloads, I know there's a request to do a caseload study, and I certainly support that. But as was pointed out, I think that's gonna be probably a couple of years away. At the same time, we don't have to stand on an island with regard to the caseload issue, because there are other states and other organizations across the country that have done studies, and pretty much consistently, they end up at pretty much the same place, which I believe is somewhere around 60 cases, you know, somewhere, you know, Washington just did 45 clients or 60 cases. I think that'll actually even change again in a couple of years to even less. You know, obviously our number of 141 is a pretty much, I would think, an outlier on that. And so I would certainly hope the work group would consider some interim step until the workload study is done. Maybe we don't go all the way to where we think it might be, because that we might miss that, but it seems like there could be some adjustments made that would be helpful. I think the other thing to think about as we think about these issues are there are factors of this that affect the need, because I do agree with the speakers based upon what I've looked at over the last year or so when looking at this a little bit deeper. We are, I think, pretty drastically understating the need. And so when the legislature and the Department of Finance are looking at the need for this, they're saying, oh, we're not that far off. I mean, even though it's several tens of millions of dollars off of what the need is, but I think it's probably significantly more than that. If the need is, if we have appropriate caseloads in there, if we think about the parent client ratio that we're apparently estimating right now that we have numbers for, if the speakers are right, those type of things, I think affect the branch's ability and the advocate's ability to advocate for funding for what I think is one of the most important case types that we handle in our system with regard to impacts on children. And then I'll just say one more thing and then I'll pause, although I have more thoughts. You know, I do think the other issue that's pretty significant, again, this sort of goes, I think, to need, not so much allocation, because it affects everyone. But I think our current formula uses an attorney salary that's based on, I think the speaker said it was, and the report says a level of one or two. But my understanding is that's an attorney in county counsel's office that has between 0 and 3 years of service. The speaker said today, I think that the average is about 16 years of service. And I know from my experience in talking to our local providers, there are some really experienced attorneys in this work who are so dedicated to it, and to sort of be compensating their providers at a 0 to 3 year attorney level seems like something we should rethink. And my understanding is that that's you know, doesn't even really take into account, for instance, even the directors of the programs, who obviously many of them have been there for decades, they're still sort of funded at a 0 to 3 level. So I just think there's a lot of work to do here. And I'm glad to hear that we're not going to try to parse it here in this meeting. I do think it would be helpful to get into a room and probably over several meetings, kind of dig into these and see if we can come up with a recommendation for us all to consider. But I just want to thank FMS for taking this up. I think it's an important issue that's it's timely to be addressed.
Thanks, David. I think you just made a strong case for being on the work group. Judge, I saw David Yamasaki, but now your hand went down.
No, I lowered it because I thought I was going to be next up, but
you are.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. So in the interest of time, I'm not going to repeat many of the things that David Slayton had mentioned, because I'm very much aligned with many of the things that he had stated. But I also wanted to mention the fact that many of the challenges that were identified by the speakers are consistent across the board. Whether you're small, medium, or large court, we have many of the same problems. So I think having a broader work group look into this will cover more ground so that we can take a look at some of the maybe nuanced differences or consistent practices so that we can finalize recommendations for consideration going forward. So I support the approach and welcome the opportunity to chime in if needed. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Judge Clark.
I won't repeat what David Slayton and David Yamasaki said. I'll just add a judicial perspective, having been a dependency judge for 5 years, that these issues are so important. They can't be handled just piecemeal or off the cuff. They really require some concentrated effort. And so I really support the notion of establishing a working group to look at this carefully, because the complexity of these cases has increased exponentially, and that has to be reflected in what we both want in the caliber of attorneys who handle these cases, but how we compensate them and how we provide for those providers. So I really support that as well.
Thanks, Judge Clark. Kim Turner.
So, you know, I should always follow David Slayton, because he makes all my points for them very eloquently. But I will say this, you know, we haven't looked at the caseload standard in a quarter of a century. That's a long, long time. And there are, I think, 6 bullet points that talk about the way the caseload has changed over that time. You know, every one of these elements of the methodology need to be reviewed, I think, at this point. But and I realized that doing a full-blown time study, that would take a very long time. I'm wondering if one of the tasks of the working group would be to look for other states who could, you know, that have done a recent caseload study that could potentially act as a proxy, so that we wouldn't have to do our own. We could adopt something that looks like it's statistically, you know, relevant, that it checks all the boxes for having been done in a way that we, you know, can agree with and so forth. Because I think it will take several years to get anything to come out of the chute if we have to do all of these, you know, really, really labor intensive pieces ourselves. So, but I want to also just support the idea of the attorneys that do this work. It's a, you know, it's a passion project. It's not just, you know, coming in to do the calendar or whatever. They really take a lot of time with these families, and to be compensating them at the level of a brand new, you know, junior attorney is, you know, it's just not, in my humble opinion, right. So I think we do need to have a complete look at all of this once again, looking at all the different factors. And I think a working group is the way to go. But if there are any ways that the working group can determine that it can accelerate how quickly we're able to come back to tick back with some recommendations, I think that would be time well spent.
David Slayton.
Sorry, that'll make this a whole lot quicker this time. I just wanted to say one thing, which is to really thank the council for the memo that's put out, because I've been looking at this issue in a lot of detail. I think they have identified the basic issues in the memo that lays out all the format, and the questions that are asked there, I think, are right on point. So I, to the degree that whenever you're, if there needs to be a motion for a work group, I'll be happy to make it. But also, I think it's a great roadmap. The memo is a great roadmap for, you know, not to say that the work group has to be constrained by that, but I do think it's a good place to start for the work of the work group.
Thanks, David. So on your question about a motion, my understanding is that as the co-chairs of FMS, I think Judge Conklin and I can appoint an FMS member working group. I don't think we need a motion for that, and I trust that somebody on staff will quickly jump in and give me the hook if I'm wrong. So I think what I would ask is that I'm hearing a very strong consensus for a working group as opposed to trying to solve this in the next 20 minutes substantively. And so I would ask anyone who is interested in being on that working group, and I agree that Kelly and Audrey and CFCC have really given that group a really good map to start with. But if you are interested, any FMS members in being on that working group, if you can just email me and Judge Conklin, I think the final appointment probably lies with him. So I don't want to take advantage of his absence to overexercise what authority I may have. But if you email the two of us, we'll get that together, recognizing that there is some urgency here and recognizing that, you know, the working group may make recommendations, you know, sort of seriatim, and we sort of fix things immediately and then we fix bigger things down the road. I think that'll work. So any further discussion? Otherwise, I will say let's consider that there will be a working group on this, and I will work with Judge Conklin on figuring out who's going to be on it. Okay. So we have one more. Thank you, by the way. And thank you, Kelly. And thank you, Audrey, for waiting in the wings. And thank you again to all the public commenters for sort of helping frame all this up. I think it is an important issue, and it's really helpful to have all the perspectives. We do have one more item. It's an informational item. This is just to provide updates on various FMS work plan items, including the reevaluation of the court cluster system, workload formula adjustment requests submitted during the last cycle, which are now under review. And I believe Kristen Greenaway, manager with JC Research Analytics and Data, is going to give us those updates.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, members of the committee. So yes, I'm here to update some items that were on the FMS work plan that were referred to DAC. And so I'll start with the two ARPs and finish with the clusters. And just for time, maybe I'll have questions after the two ARPs and then move on to the clusters. So I'll just take a minute to summarize and update. So we have two adjustment request proposals, or ARPs, were submitted by the Superior Court of Alameda County and the Superior Court of Stanislaus County. They were received in January and submitted to DAC in March of this year. So the request from Alameda proposes a minimum staff to judge ratio be factored into the RAS model, the resource assessment study model, as a supplemental need and included in the workload formula calculations. Specifically, the proposal recommends factoring the minimum staff needed to support authorized judgeships when measuring each court's staffing based need. And I'll just say that so there are court, essentially it kind of boils down, there are courts in the state where the workload models don't reflect the staff need to support the authorized judgeships in those courts. So DAC has reviewed and discussed at its May and August meetings of this past year and determined a need for further discussion. So a work group was initially formed, and then through the annual agenda process, a subcommittee was developed to discuss the proposal in more detail. The committee met this month. They'll meet again in the new year. And then we hope to have a report back to the full committee to DAC at our March meeting. And then bring it back to TCBAC if it's resolved in the March, or something to send back to TCBAC in March. And then I'll just go ahead and there's also an ARP received from the Superior Court of Stanislaus County, which proposed a factor in the resource assessment study model to be included in the workload formula calculations that accounts for additional time and costs to conduct background checks using the automated firearm system for domestic violence restraining orders that was required by AB 3083, and that went into effect in January of 2025. The committee reviewed and discussed this ARP again at its May and August meetings. While the committee recognized the impacts to court workload due to AB 3083, the committee felt the workload impacts were not uniform enough across all courts to address through an interim adjustment to the RAS model. So the RAS model was updated in 2024, just missing this 2025 implementation date. Any changes that do impact workload would be captured in the next update to the model. And then just also note, we recently updated the judicial workload model. So any workload that is conducted by judges related to AB 3083 would be captured in those case weights that will be applied for the judicial workload update. That memo, so the committee voted, but the memo will be approved by the by DAC, by the full committee in January, and then submitted to TCBAC after that. So are there any questions on the two ARPs?
I don't think so.
Okay. All right. And then, so the next item is clusters. This item in 2023, the cluster project was referred to the Data Analytics Advisory Committee. And I'll just give a little background since the cluster issue has been around for a while and different projects have been worked on around it. So I just wanted to give a little bit of history and background. So following work done on clusters around 2018, 2019, 2020, subcommittee members, FMS subcommittee members had remaining questions, which is kind of before DAC right now. And that is, should authorized judicial positions be used to determine clusters? And is their use still relevant today are kind of the overriding questions. I'll just briefly give a history of the clusters. I'm sure we're all very aware of the clusters, but I want to make sure everyone's on the same page. So clusters were established in the early 2000s, and they were based on each court's number of authorized judicial positions. AJP was used as a proxy for size of court, which is kind of the determining why we wanted to have clusters, that there were workload differences based on the size of courts. And AJP was selected in part because it is a stable number that changes infrequently over time. So those clusters wouldn't be changing every year if we used a different metric. And as you're all aware, that it's currently a four cluster model. Cluster four consists of the largest courts in the state. Cluster one consists of all those two judge courts. And then clusters two and three occupy the middle range of court size. And then clustering is used in both the RAS and the workload formula, the resource assessment study model and the workload formula. The two areas in RAS that it's used are to establish supervisor and managers to staff ratios and to establish administrative staff to operations staff in the RAS model. And that's because when we do the RAS update, those staff are not part of the time study. They're not part of the case weights, but we need to build in that complement of staff when we're converting those staff to dollars in the workload formula. And then in the workload formula, it's used to develop the court executive salary and also to compute the operational, the operating expenses and equipment, or OE&E. And in that one, it's really just cluster one, and then all the other clusters are grouped together because the real difference is in cluster one. And so there's also a policy on the workload formula side. I think it's still used. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but that was that all cluster one courts should be funded to 100%. So that was also a little bit of a cluster, the clusters had an impact in that. So the only change really, again, there was some work done in 2018, 2019, 2020. The only real change to clusters was with San Francisco. They submitted an ARP due to a change in their authorized judicial positions. So they had reduced their SJOs by about 14, I believe. And so they had requested to move from cluster four, the courts in the largest cluster, to cluster three. And that was approved by the council in 2020. So after all that, the committee has not made any real progress on this. We do have a new chair. We briefed him on this issue. It's on our work plan. And I don't know if I think Jake left the call, but I know he had some questions. So we may end up asking some questions back to FMS to move forward on this issue. And that's all I have on those issues.
Thanks, Kristen. Anybody have any questions for Kristen on the cluster issue? And as she mentioned, Jake is the new chair of DAC. I think everybody knows. So, and he's also on this committee. So we're uniquely positioned to ask him questions as well if we need to. All right. Well, thank you, Kristen. Much appreciated for the updates.
Absolutely.
So that, I believe, concludes our agenda items. Although I did want to note before we adjourn that the email went out for budget priority information for fiscal year 27-28. So if you all could just remember to communicate with your assigned courts and to submit your responses through the online form by COB on January 5th. That information will help develop funding priorities and BCP recommendations for the benefit of all the courts. I also want to note this is our last FMS meeting for 2025. The first full TIC-BAC meeting for 2026 is scheduled for January 15th, 2026, which is just a few days after the governor's January budget proposal will be out. And depending on what is included in that budget proposal, we think we may need to convene FMS earlier in 2026. So just a heads up on that. With that, if there's nothing else, I wish everybody happy holidays. I hope you all get to enjoy some time off. And I am going to take the opportunity as co-chair to say, go Bears, who are threatening to take the NFC North. Or keep it, I should say. And on behalf of my dear friend Zlatko and a fellow Blue and Orange Team fan, I will also grudgingly say go Broncos. So anyway, thank you guys. I appreciate you all, and I hope you all have a great holiday season.
You as well. Happy
Thank
holidays.
you. Really appreciate
See you,
you.
everybody.